is Jane Latour on Saturday, December 18th, 2004, with Angela Olszewski. And that's Olszewski.
Correct.
So, Angela, tell me a bit about when you were born, where you were born and raised.
Okay, I was born in St. John's Hospital in Queens on March 27th, 1970. I was a breech birth and I came out feet first. My parents are from Greenpoint, Brooklyn. I'm from Greenpoint, Brooklyn. My grandparents are from Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
Nice Polish neighborhood.
Polish neighborhood. Mom's Italian. The folks in the family who came through Ellis Island basically got off at Ellis Island, went to Greenpoint, and stayed there for 100 years. Both my parents, to sum it up, are workers. They have been working since childhood. My mother dropped out of school. She convinced her mother to sign her out of school. I believe they told the school she was going to Italy. And she went to work as a teenager at a machine embroidery sweatshop, basically, in Brooklyn. And her sister have done that all their life. My mother still has her embroidery machine. My cousins and I used to go to the factory. It was just a little shop.
What neighborhood is it in?
In Greenpoint.
Okay.
Yeah. It's gone now. Mm-hmm. The business, my mother actually took that business over when the owner retired. But my cousins and I all have memories of, you know, before there was take your daughters to work day, I was going to work with my parents. My dad
was
worked,
that a sweatshop unionized or
non-union. And in fact, we figured out recently that all that hard work my mother's put in, she does not have enough credits for Social Security, so we have to figure something out for her. Yeah, it's horrendous, really. But you know, back then, you thought you were doing the right thing, just work hard, make your money.
Mm-hmm.
My dad worked as a kid. One of his proud stories is that when he was 15, he bought a car. And it sat in the lot, and he would go and start the car up and move it around in the lot. But he had worked so hard as a kid, working in laundromats and delis and things, that he had bought this car. He then got a job with my grandfather at Taylor's Iron Foundry in Greenpoint. My grandfather was a shop steward in Taylor's Iron Foundry, and the stories my father told, it was such hard work.
What union?
I don't know that. I've gone online to look that up, and I can't find much information on it. I believe Taylor's Iron Foundry went to India. And if you look at the gratings and the sewer covers in New York City, sometimes you'll see it'll say Taylor on it. And this is the kind of heavy, hard work my grandfather did. He, in fact, had two hip replacements, and we attribute it to like repetitive stress injury from the job.
Mm-hmm.
My grandfather was also a bartender on the weekends, and when he was a kid, he used to deliver ice with his father in a horse and wagon.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So this is all what was going on in Greenpoint.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where it really begins, because I know my dad must have been a kid at the dinner table with my grandfather, listening to my grandfather tell the shop steward stories. And what happened with me is my dad, after working at the iron foundry, he also got a job at Continental Can Company, steel company, when it was in, I believe it was in Long Island City. But they closed up shop in the 70s and went south to Jersey, and then even further south, I believe, south of the border.
I worked for them for 1 month.
Did you?
I did.
In New Jersey.
Yeah.
Really?
But that's another story.
Do you know Arthur Shiotkowski?
No, okay. 1 month.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that was short. So after that, my dad had a couple of different stints in building maintenance. My dad was always a very handy guy.
Mm-hmm.
He still is. But the big break in terms of a job for my family came when my dad got called up for the New York City Department of Sanitation. He had taken the test in his 20s, and there was a freeze on hiring for so very long. He got cold in his 30s. But at that point, my family, you know, was relieved because this is a job
good
where you think,
job.
Right, a good paying job, 5 weeks vacation, unlimited sick, and, you know, steady over time when it snows, all good things. Mm-hmm. So at that point, when my dad got that job, my parents finally had a second child.
Boy so, or girl?
A girl. Uh-huh. My sister Jacqueline.
So their father became a member of the Teamsters then?
Yes. He says, though, they are considered affiliated with the Teamsters, okay. that they're not actually Teamsters.
They have
Teamsters.
Own union local.
Yes. Right.
Yeah. And so, did you work with your dad? You said he was handy. Did you work
yes.
with him around the house?
Yes. My parents were always working so much, so much. They took a big chance in the 70s before real estate went crazy. And they purchased two properties in Brooklyn, two six-family apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. And my father knew he could fix them. Mm-hmm. And not at that time because I was too young,
yeah.
but over the years as I got older, I began to help him mm-hmm. with renovations and you know, carrying lumber and sheetrock mm-hmm. and all sorts of things. And I still do it to this day because we're still fixing up some of
yeah.
the apartments
mm-hmm.
as older tenants who've been there for very long have gone out mm-hmm. and so on.
And now he has a skilled tradesperson.
Oh, yes. I recently renovated two bathrooms in the buildings, and I could see it blew them both away. You know, I could see that because before that, I'd really helped my dad with things like demolition, mm-hmm. you know, rough
yeah,
work.
Right.
And I came in and I did these two bathrooms. I tiled them up, grouted mm-hmm. them. And my dad's handy, but if you don't do something like tiling every
right.
day,
uh-huh.
you're going to go slow at it.
Right.
So he was just floored about how quickly I did it
mm-hmm.
and it turned it around.
They
were beaming, yeah. They
yeah.
were beaming with pride, I could tell.
So tell me about your education.
I went to Catholic grade school in Greenpoint and Catholic high school in Queens, St. Stanislaus in Greenpoint and St. John's Prep in
mm-hmm.
Queens. And I went to SUNY Binghamton for a semester, my first semester of college.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't like being away.
Yeah, that's far.
It's far, and you know, when you're so used to New York City,
mm-hmm.
how could, you know,
real
it was
country.
Real quiet,
yeah.
just too quiet for me. And I came back and I transferred and finished up at Queens College.
Mm-hmm.
I got a BA in communications, film and video production.
Oh, good. So, how would you describe yourself politically?
Politically, labels, it's troubling.
Mm. Well, just sort of put yourself in some kind of
liberal.
General, yeah.
it's
like, I always say I'm a socialist, even though it doesn't mean anything because I don't do anything with anybody else, but, you know, that's
right.
my, if I had to put a label on myself.
Right, and I'm registered as an independent,
uh-huh.
which, you know, I just, there's good and bad in all of it, you know.
Right, exactly.
So
I'm registered
to,
as a Democrat, and that's problematic. Just
yeah.
so I could vote in the primaries. In
right,
York.
And I've considered switching to Democratic just
because that. Yeah.
that's what the political machine is offering
right,
us,
right.
you know.
Yeah. Okay, so,
yeah,
you know, it's not a real important question, I guess. So what jobs did you have prior to going to into a pre-apprentice program?
Prior to pre-apprenticeship, I had so many jobs. You know, when you're living in New York City, you are a butcher, a baker, a candlestick maker to pay the rent and
mm-hmm.
keep up with the cost of living in this city. I was a dental assistant when I was a teenager. Don't ask me how, but I was
yeah.
shooting x-rays and doing things like that.
Wow.
And I had no technician
yeah.
skills. That was a short-lived job,
mm-hmm.
but I sold cigars at a place
wow.
called Mom Cigars on 5th Avenue and 20th. They're not there anymore, but they were there for over 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
They had a big write-up in Cigar Aficionado.
Smoke.
Uh-huh. Yeah, when cigars were this big thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I worked at a place called Competitrack, which is a marketing research company. Basically, it's glamorous sounding, but
mm-hmm.
I basically sat at the computer with a stack of newspapers
mm-hmm.
from all over the country, Washington
mm-hmm.
Post, Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, and I leaf through all of the pages of the paper looking for advertisements. And when I come across them, I had to measure them, and I had to go in the computer and say, okay, I found the AT&T ad. It was 4x6. It had two colors, you know, and it was whatever this, you know, get 100 minutes free or some, whatever the, what am I looking for, the gimmick was. And so it was an electronic sweatshop is what I called it, you know.
Yeah.
And it was $8 an hour, no benefits. Right. A lot of people were going to college that were there, you know, it was just that kind of job. I worked at Brinks Armored Car Company.
Oh,
I worked there during their night shift. I worked in the money room. I counted millions and millions of dollars in cash night after night.
There actually is such a thing. I just thought they were Briggs trucks that drove around. See, I never took it to the next step.
Right. They bring it to Fort Knox and we count the money. And it was hilarious because it was the kind of place, you remember the TV show Get Smart?
Yeah.
In the opening of the show, he walks through all the doors.
Right.
That's how Brinks is on the inside. You have to look at a camera, and then they buzz you through to the next job, to the next spot. But what's very interesting about that job is it used to be a union job.
Right. And Brinks drivers were Teamsters.
Right. And Brinks busted up the union.
Wow.
It happened well before I got there.
Yeah.
And I realized, you know, while I was there, that just something was strange.
Mm-hmm.
And like all the management was white and all the workers were really mostly people of color.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a white guy on the day shift and I was the white girl on the night shift. And I, right there, the picture felt weird. I brought it up to management, how come there's not a nighttime differential, you know, at this time of year when we would get the Toys R Us accounts and stuff, we'd be counting money till like 4 a.m. And what Brinks started doing, or maybe they'd been doing it, is every 3 months we'd have a meeting. And at the meeting, they would explain to us how it would not be good if we had a union here.
Oh.
And they said, if anybody ever asks you to sign cards or this and that, you're going to, you know, you're gonna spoil what we have here and blah, blah, blah.
Was it well paid?
It was only like 8 and change, 9 when I left. Mm-hmm. And I don't consider that really well paid.
So you left. And so let's segue over to the trades.
All right.
How did you hear about NEW, non-traditional employment for women?
Well, I heard about NEW while I was at Brinks. It was in 95, and I heard it from friends of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I went over to NEW getting some information, and they said, well, you have to be on public assistance or collecting unemployment to go through the program. And at the time, I was not. So I just said, okay, I'll file that in the back of my head, and if I find myself in that situation, I'll come running to the door. Just before I got into NEW, I was working at New York City Parks and Recreation in their permit office. I was a seasonal clerical ass associate, I mean, and I sold tennis permits.
And were you in the union?
I was in DC 37, however, I worked in the very high-profile location called the Arsenal, which is where the former Parks Commissioner Henry Stern worked. And there was no union literature around. And
were you in Local 983? Do you remember?
I believe it was called 15-something.
Okay.
Not
there's
90,
so many. 1505, 1507.
I would have to look at my pay stub.
That's
it's
all right.
On there.
It's just,
Something strange happened there where I confronted them about some union issues. Henry Stern had this quirky thing where he gave out parks names if he liked you. And it was an indication that you would be able to stay on. Because it was explained to me and the other woman that they hired, well, you know, this could be an opportunity for you to get a full-time position with Parks Department. But it all depends. It all depends on the budget, this and that. Basically, they tried to play the two of us against each other to compete.
And did Henry give you a name?
No. At first I had one picked out, but I basically got upset because we were selling these tennis permits, and while we were in this room selling these permits, they renovated the room and cut out a new window in the wall. Mm-hmm. And they said, all right, listen, when it's not too busy, can you sell t-shirts at that window? And I said, well, that's another job description. So will you pay me two salaries, or, you know, should I call the union and ask them what I should do about this? And they were like, oh, please don't call the union. So I really didn't get involved with that t-shirt window. Mm-hmm. The other girl, you know, basically I spoke up, and the other two people in the room backed off and then complied, because they wanted those jobs, and it wasn't worth it to me.
Let me
tell you this. Okay. It's, you know, really, Henry needs to be exposed. Mm. This old-timer, Ephraim, came to the window. He's a maintenance guy. And one of the things they let you do with these t-shirts, these Parks Department t-shirts, is have your name put on them. So Henry came to me and he said, listen, can you, you know, get them to get me a baseball hat with my name? And I gave it to the manager. And he said, no, Ephraim can't have that, because Henry only wants people who have Parks names to have their names put on these Parks Department clothing. And I said, that is ridiculous. This guy, Ephraim, had like 19 years of service with Parks Department, and they wouldn't let him get a hat with his name on it. I was furious. And basically, about a week after that, they said, we don't need you anymore.
And your season was up.
Yeah, my season was up, and it truly was. And I said, wow, you're laying me off? Great. Yay. And I ran right to New.
So you started at New, and tell me, what was your motivation for wanting to learn a skill trade?
Well, I just maybe mythologized in my head, but I just figured, skilled construction trades, I bet those unions are good. I bet those unions get paid well, and I bet, you know, that there's solidarity there. That was my ideals about it. And I definitely wanted to go into a skilled finishing trade where my work would show, because I really was going after it with a lot of measure of pride. I wanted to really get involved in something and be proud of it and work hard and be like, yeah, union, this is the way to go.
Okay, so you went to New, and how long does that program last?
At the time that I enrolled, it was a 12-week full-time program.
Wow.
Now it's abbreviated to 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. And how did it happen that you get to choose from trades, as I understand, from those unions that are looking for apprentices?
Yes.
So how did you... What was the selection process, and how did you end up with the tile setters?
Well, I came through the door at New saying I wanted to be a bricklayer.
Okay.
And I knew I had an affection for cement. You know, I wanted to work with cement. And I sat down with the director at the time, Melinda DeMaio, and she explained to me that the brick layers weren't, they're in construction in New York City, they don't really do what I was after. And again, I was looking at it very romantically. I wanted to do arches, and I was thinking, like, what I could do with landscaping, and like what you see in old, beautiful old brick buildings. But really, brick work nowadays in new construction is facade, and it's very plain. You know, there's a lot of iron lintels, and there's no arches over windows and things. And so she kind of discouraged me about it, and it was good that she did, because as time went by and I learned more about that union, I'm glad I didn't go in that direction. It would have broke my heart. So I was at New for the 12 weeks, did the training, and basically, they made me aware of the opportunities that were available, first and foremost. And I remember bridge painter was a big one. elevator repair, tile, marble, terrazzo, and electrician. And I thought about, and carpenter, it was almost always open there. So I went to the library and I took out a bunch of books on the tile. Bunch of books, stacked books, like all the thickness of a telephone book. And I started leafing through the pages and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with it because it's such a finishing trade, and I was looking at, I remember this one thing that stuck in my head, these tile that were inside a canal that was around like a palace. And this rich family had this tiled canal that they would, you know, go through with their gondolas or whatever. And it was from the 14th century. And I thought, wow, yeah, that's what I want. I want to put something up and I want it to last, you know, longer than me.
Now, we all basically know what tile is, not to the degree that you do, and marble we know, but terrazzo. Could you explain what terrazzo is?
Sure.
You've made me aware of that. Every time I see it now, the word, I think of you, but what is it?
Terrazzo is a type of flooring. It can also be cast into stairs, shower pans, and other things. But basically what it is it's broken up bits of marble, okay, and you use these zinc metal strips, and when you see terrazzo, it's usually in a large public building, like a museum, a public space, some of the old post office, big places. Okay, so they take the metal strips and they make a framework on the floor. And they put a cementitious base in the area of the outlined by the strips, and then they pour these marble chips. And they pour a lot of them, and they pack it in. I mean, they really put a lot in, and they flat trowel over the top of the stones. And what that does is it makes the stone's most flat surface come to the top. Okay, and then they have to let that set, and the next day they grind it flat to the strip, and then they polish, and you have a beautiful marble chip floor. And you can do it in different colors. They have new products where they use these epoxies inside the cement that create like really rich colors. I was at a Disney store in New Jersey, and they had a terrazzo Mickey Mouse face on the floor. Just, it was so perfect. And, you know, all the colors, the black ears, the white face, red around, circles and gold. You can do some really, it's a very labor-intensive process, very expensive, but it's, if installed properly, guaranteed to last 100 years, so.
I'll be on the lookout.
Okay.
So tell me now about new. I have a question here. How much did you know about the industry and the history of the unions? And you basically have already answered that. You had a romantic view. You really didn't know about the history of the building trades and the history of the building trades in New York City. But
right. What my understanding of unions was basically through my father and other extended members of my family. I had a lot of uncles who were in the Department of Sanitation. I have cousins who are in police and firefighter union. And basically, my family, all in a chorus, would say, take the test, get in a union, take the test, and do that. And there's a really interesting bit with me and my dad. When he got into the sanitation, probably because he just retired 20 years of picking up garbage, it's unbelievable to me. About the last 10 years of that 20 years, my dad did quite a bit of his own rabble-rousing, because the Department of Sanitation, things have changed. When my dad started at that job, it was a three-man truck picking up garbage. And during his time there, it was reduced to two men.
Yeah.
You know, one driving, one lifting.
Yeah.
And part of that comes out of the fact that the workers would run the route, and they'd all finish before noon, or what have you, and mm-hmm. people would go home, and the city of New York and the people that are watching say, hey, you know, what are we going to pay mm-hmm. for this, you know? Right. But my dad would try to talk to the men and say, you know, you're going to throw your back out, you're going to mess up your elbows, mm-hmm. and what happens to a lot of men who retire from sanitation is they stop moving and they die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They retire, and in 2 years mm-hmm. from the relaxing, mm-hmm. they have heart attacks and die. So one of the things my dad started doing with his partner was to work his 7-hour day. Mm-hmm. And he was getting a lot of flack mm-hmm. from higher-ups about mm-hmm. that. And I began to help him with his grievance letters.
Oh, yeah.
Because neither of my parents finished high school. So my dad would give me a synopsis mm-hmm. or some notes, and I would compose his grievance letters. Mm-hmm. And that, from 16 on, I was doing that for him.
Uh-huh.
And that really started to educate me about the process of grievance mm-hmm. and fairness and justice. Mm-hmm.
And the union as a tool for representing
right.
aggrieved workers. Okay, so then you come into the building trades. So we'll get back to the unions, but I just wondered about that question. So tell me about the, what were the chief benefits of the program at NEW?
For me, I felt that the benefits were NEW's political connections and NEW's networking connections. Mm-hmm. So I had a bit of trouble getting into Local 7 at first. They said come the first Tuesday of every month between the months of, I think it was March and December. And I showed up on the first Tuesday of November, it was election day.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, why are you here? What are you talking about? What application?
Where are they located?
The office for the application and training is in Long Island City. I can't think of the address
That's all
right off the top of my head. Yeah. And I went back to NEW and reported what had happened. And basically, the director at the time, Martha Baker, and the job developer, Susan Wilson, went to work to iron out the details mm-hmm. of my return in December, where there was an application, there were other people making applications, and uh-huh. I took a little math test and filled out a paper. And yes, the gentleman, Phil Avrazano, who made the application said, so why do you want to do this? You know?
Yeah.
Like, it was peculiar for me, but not the other people in the room.
Right.
You know?
And the other people in the room were all male?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Uh-huh. And so, your answer?
My answer is that it's a beautiful trait. It's absolutely.
And he must have liked that answer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was an excellent ally. Unfortunately, he ran against the current treasurer of my local,
mm-hmm.
and he lost. And he lost his position as an instructor mm-hmm. at the school, and I haven't seen him in politics or on any job site since mm-hmm. then.
And he was a good instructor.
He was a very good instructor.
Mm-hmm. So that was a benefit of NEW, and then it sort of acclimated you to get ready to go into an apprenticeship?
Yes. NEW was very strict about attendance, punctuality. Mm-hmm. I remember women being told, I'm sorry, but you've been late too many times. You know, you have to leave the program, and mm-hmm. people cried and were
trying,
you know,
to get people ready for the discipline in the workplace.
Yes, yes. And it you cannot understress how important it is mm-hmm. to be on time. And that means really early in the trade.
Mm-hmm.
That means really early. Be on the job by 6:30. Be there.
Mm-hmm.
Have your cup of coffee, chill out, and mm-hmm. you know, don't be the one rushing in at the last minute.
Tell me about any difficulties or obstacles that you had during the time at NEW.
Funny enough, I had a hairline fracture in my thumb playing basketball.
Oh.
In the phys ed class,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't realize it at the time. Mm-hmm. I kept playing ball, or, you know, so that was a little funny and fuzzy to mm-hmm. have that kind of injury.
Yeah, and then you're going in to use your hands to do
the
trade.
Yeah, So. Yeah, so that was a little...
Has that ironed out now?
Oh, yeah, no yeah. trouble with it okay. at all.
So tell me about the graduation ceremony from New. There was a graduation ceremony?
There was a graduation ceremony. I have kept my program from that day.
Uh-huh.
It was great. I mean, there were like two people who dropped out of our class, but the rest of us really hung in there.
Uh-huh. Got close?
We got close during the 12 weeks, and people really, you know, if you saw somebody sinking, you picked them up, you know. Mm-hmm. We were tight like that. I wrote and read a poem at the ceremony. Mm-hmm. And
I would love a copy.
Sure. It was really tied to the context of the experience that we all had, but what was really amazing to me is that when I looked out at the audience, they were applauding like crazy, and so many people had tears in their eyes. I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it, and it was
and
really...
And did you folks come?
No, at the time, I wasn't really speaking to them.
Oh.
They...
So we were just speaking about... this is this side two... Mm-hmm. And we were just talking about you and your parents and
yeah.
them, you know, you had a kind of a rupture
yeah,
over your sexual preference.
That's right.
And
yeah. we lost some years actually over mm-hmm. that. And in the past couple of years we're gaining our ground back.
So that's we want to touch on this subject again. That's you know, mm-hmm. it takes courage in this society that has so much hate to, you know, to be who you are. And the other way is to be not who you are. And that's, you know, that's no way to live.
Yeah, boy, does that take energy, too.
Yeah.
Too much energy.
So, you know, but we'll revisit this, but your parents weren't at the graduation. So now we'll move on to the apprenticeship. So between, after New, then you went to the apprenticeship. And you started the apprenticeship when?
I graduated New in December of 99,
uh-huh.
and I was not given a firm confirmation that I would be training with the Tile Union,
uh-huh.
Or that they would be beginning a class anytime soon. They kept telling me, we don't know, uh-huh. we don't know, we don't know. Well, as it ended up, I waited until February 14th,
uh-huh.
they started a class.
Uh-huh.
And it was another full-time 12-week training.
Uh-huh.
So I had done the 12 weeks
uh-huh.
at New.
But the apprenticeship was only 12 weeks?
No.
Oh.
It's the Bricklayers Union
uh-huh.
runs what they call pre-job training.
Oh, okay.
And it's a 12-week pre-job.
To
all the trades.
Yep.
Bricklayers, marble, terrazzo, tile, we all do a 12-week
mm-hmm.
pre-job
okay.
where we go full-time
uh-huh.
for training. And I explain to my students, because I do teach at New now, that they must be patient with this process. It
mm-hmm.
takes a while.
Yeah.
And it takes a while for me, it takes a while for the
mm-hmm.
men, for these things to kind of
yeah.
happen. So 12 weeks at New, 6 weeks of waiting, 12 more weeks of training
uh-huh.
in tile. It was, you know... 6.5 months before I went to work.
And then
in this process.
How was it when you for that 12 that 6 weeks?
Well,
the 12 weeks
during
week of training.
The 6 weeks
okay.
I worked a bit at New helping out. When
uh-huh.
I winterized, I put plastic on the windows, I changed the garbage, I did some work like that around there, and that really helped to stay involved with New
uh-huh.
and to speak to. New members, new students that were being enrolled and things like that,
mm-hmm.
that really, you know, sort of kept my morale up. Susan Wilson is, you know, my dear, dear friend,
mm-hmm.
and she, you know, she just would always give me a pat on the back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
She
has a wonderful, warm, affirming nature.
Yes,
yeah.
yes. And so I got enrolled in this 12-week tile pre-job, and there were... 5 other guys
mm-hmm.
and me.
Okay.
And
what was the response?
It was fine.
Mm-hmm.
It was really fine with the guy Phil Arizona, who was the instructor.
Mm-hmm.
He was just like a jolly good guy
mm-hmm.
as a teacher. I don't know what at what level his politics were in the union at that point, you know,
but
just getting started.
It wasn't an issue.
And because the class was so small, mm-hmm. you know, we had his attention, and I basically could ask him anything I wanted, and he was always right there. He wasn't managing a class mm-hmm. of 30. In a couple of weeks, one of those guys dropped out. So then it was just four other guys and me, right? Yeah. That was Damian Lynch, Ralph Martinez, Craig Cavallo, and this guy, Robbie Rashid.
Mm-hmm.
And me, Ralph, and Robbie trained to be tile mechanics, mm-hmm. and Craig and Damian were training to be tile finishers, which are basically helpers. Mm-hmm. They help the mechanics,
uh-huh.
and they also grout the work that we do. And things went real smooth. The only thing that was a little troubling is the school simultaneously ran training in brick, marble. They weren't running the terrazzo at the school yet. The stone apprentices worked at night. But the brick layers that were training, I joked to friends that it was like being in the Rikers Island after school program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to go further in kind of joking about that, because I believe people should be able to pick themselves up and change their lives
right.
and go forward. But the bricklayer kids were more rough around the edges. And I did have one incident at the school where I had asked one of the fellas to give me some mud, which is cement,
mm-hmm.
and he said, give me a kiss first. And I was like, you know, don't talk to me like that. What, you know, what's your freaking problem,
right.
blah, blah. And he got all offensive back, like,
yeah.
oh, you know,
right.
why are you so uptight, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then there was this whole, like, revelation where they all figure out I was a dyke.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and confirm that with me, like, so do you have a boyfriend, you know,
yeah.
that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And I was the only woman at that facility except for the secretary.
Wow. And yeah. how was the secretary to you?
The secretary was pleasant, very pleasant. Hi, Ange, how you doing? Yeah, she was more aligned with the bricklayers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know really that we'll explore it here, but there's basically some tension between Local 7, Tile Marble Terrazzo, and Local 1, which is Stone, Brick, and PCC. So she worked for Local 1, and she was kind of having her own labor issues about taking on the paperwork for Local 7 apprentices.
I see.
So.
Yeah. So, but, so did were you, up front with them about your sexuality?
Oh,
and
yeah.
And did they use that against you, or was it to become, I mean, how did they handle that?
I felt like it was just a curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being that they were younger guys, you know, they watch television, there's, you know, kind of a, you got the Real World MTV stuff, and, you know, they just probably looked at me like, you know, just another character,
uh-huh.
you know,
yeah.
in this business.
Uh-huh.
I remember one guy telling me that after a while I was going to get a beer belly, like all the men in construction,
uh-huh.
and he said to me, and it's going to look really funny on you.
And there you are drinking a beer. Well, but no beer belly. So tell me about the challenges and obstacles of being an apprentice. Well, you had the pre-apprentice, so then you go into the apprentice program. So
yes.
How was that? Was that a different story, or is it
well,
instructor?
To make the link
okay.
between new and my apprenticeship,
mm-hmm.
Susan Wilson, Martha Baker, Charlie Hill, and Art Cavazzi of GM Crescetti. Charlie Hill's the president of Local 7, and Art Cavazzi owns GM Crescetti. They worked out kind of a deal,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because New was aware that that Jim Crescetti was going to get a big project
okay.
that involved
and
federal money.
Uh-huh. And he's
so,
the contractor.
Yeah, and
mm-hmm.
so basically I was going to be indentured to Jim Crescetti
okay.
and get to work on that project. Mm-hmm. Now, while I was at the school and I was training, at the end of training, I kept telling Phil Avrizano, listen, you know, I know you're telling us not to get upset if we don't get work right away, but I got this deal with Crochetti, mm-hmm. you know, so maybe you should look into it, because they basically said, the agreement went something like this. Charlie said to Arcavazzi, listen, if you take her, I'll train her. Mm-hmm. And Arcavazzi said, Charlie, listen, if you train her, I'll take her. So, mm-hmm. you know, here it was, yeah. I'm training, yeah. and I want to get to work. And I remember Phil saying to me, and this is where, like, the sexism begins, only it's very mm-hmm. subtle. Crochetti, that's a tough shop, Angela. I don't know, that's mm-hmm. a tough shop, mm-hmm. right? And it's true. Mm-hmm. The work that Crochetti does is stone marble with thinset, which is cement, basically, mm-hmm. that we use.
So it's heavy.
It's heavy work, yeah.
And you have to be able to carry things and...
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know... Spreading glue and setting little 4 1/4 tile is different from working with thinset and stone and even cutting stone and all that. But I was up for it. This is what I wanted to do. And I knew I wanted to get my hands on that material because to touch marble and to actually set every piece of marble, it's a wonderful experience. It really is. And it vibrates with me that I know this is what I should be doing. Yeah. Not hanging sheetrock, not wiring a fixture. This is what, yeah. this is the trade I want. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so at first I went out with another company doing little tile work, and then Phil showed up at the job. I wasn't there a few days.
Inspector.
Yeah, he said, Angela, you're going to do a job with Crochetti tomorrow. And I said, see, I told you. he was surprised. Uh-huh. And, off I went with Crochetti, and my first job was the Bridge Tower Apartments on First Avenue, right by 59th Street Bridge.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's where the Roosevelt Trim is, right?
Yeah,
that was the job.
Uh-huh.
And we did white Carrara marble. Oh, that was so
and
beautiful.
And where was it going?
It was going in... like the guest powder room bathroom, where it's just a toilet and a sink. And we had to install a chair rail with a miter cut and saddles. And the kitchens were granite, black granite. And the master bathrooms were this, what we call Botticino marble,
mm-hmm.
which is a beige marble. It's used all over the city. You kind of get sick of it after a while. But white Carrara is so beautiful.
And did you work with Journeyman? Did you have a partner?
Well, I did. I showed up on the job and I met the foreman. His name was Dominic Zampini and his helper was Anthony Caparelli. And funny enough, on that job when I showed up, President Charlie Hill's son, Billy Hill, was also on the job working. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you can do in my union is if you're a helper, if you're one of the finishers, at some point in your career you can say, you know what, I want to try and be a tile mechanic. It's called switching your book.
Mm-hmm.
So you figure if you've been around the business long enough, you want to give it a try. We make more money. We make, I think we're almost $9 an hour more than the helpers now. So Billy was doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So Billy was kind of like, skill-wise, like equal to me in getting his hand at this marble installation. And we did that for a while. Shortly after I got on that job, middle of May.
Mm-hmm.
In June, at the end of June, I went to masonry camp. I was invited to go to masonry camp by my international union.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a break from that job.
And how long did that last?
Masonry camp was 1 week.
Mm-hmm.
It's held out on Swan's Island in Maine.
Oh.
It's basically a public relations type of event where they bring together what they consider outstanding apprentices from all over the country, and they're all, you know, all the trades, brick, stone, marble, terrazzo, tile, mm-hmm. all different.
Were you the only one from your local?
I was the only one from my local, and there were two other women apprentices. Mm-hmm. One was a bricklayer from Detroit, and the other was a stonemason from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And then what they do is they bring us together with these architect students who are in their fifth year, mm-hmm. so they're usually working at firms mm-hmm. and stuff. And they put us in these groups, a mix of apprentices and architects, and we have to do what's called a design build project. Mm-hmm. So we spend some days designing something, we spend some days building a fragment.
Sounds like fun.
It was really incredible. And what they want to facilitate is that we understand each other, mm-hmm. the architects and the masons.
Talk to each other.
Yeah. And what was really amazing to me is the architects had such a repertoire of design. So you don't say to them, okay, we'll put a door here. They're like, well, what kind of door? And they go on and on and on about it. And for us as masons, we're so interested in the quality of how that thing is installed. You know, so, I mean, our noses are right up on our work. You know, we're worrying about plumb lines. We're worrying, like, I'm worrying about tile joints. Are they lined up? Are they this? Are they that? Whereas the architect is really pulled back, really far away from the work, but they have all these ideas. Mm-hmm. So we kind of had to come to the middle.
Yeah.
And it was a great, there was a lot of tension, but then, you know, it really worked itself out. So I returned back to that first job.
Right. And how was Billy when you got there?
Billy was gone.
Oh.
The foreman said, he was talking, and he just was saying Billy couldn't handle it yet. And that's what happens a lot in the business. They say that tile is not about production, mm-hmm. that you should go to work and give a fair day's work, but there are numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, in the bathroom of your apartment, mm-hmm. to put tile on the walls, they would say to me, you need to produce 3 of those a day
mm-hmm.
in order to remain on this job. Mm-hmm. And if in a few days I couldn't hit that number,
mm-hmm.
they'd be like, sorry,
yeah.
you know, we'll try somebody mm-hmm. else. Or do 5 floors a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it goes. And I guess Billy wasn't cutting it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that he couldn't get there, because he's obviously still learning, but that's what that foreman said. But what was interesting, I showed up, there were a lot more men there.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was this fella whose nickname is Jimmy the Jet. And it turns out he was the shop steward. And another fella, his name was Scott. I don't know his last name. And Scott and I had some problems on that job. Well, I got to know Jimmy the Jet as the shop steward, and I didn't quite understand it. Jimmy, at the time, had a serious drinking problem and serious problem with drugs. And whatever else.
And he's a steward.
And he was a steward. And I really didn't understand it. And after a while of paying attention to the foreman, I realized the foreman had some trouble too. He was recovering from a heroin addiction. And so every Tuesday we would get paid. And every Wednesday, Jimmy would be out pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
Or he'd show up in the same clothes.
Mm-hmm.
as Tuesday, and every Wednesday afternoon the foreman would leave early because he had to get medicated. And I thought, wow, this is a strange union. You know, I'm just trying to get my training here.
Right.
And
then you had this problem you mentioned with a co-worker, and
yeah.
were you looking for some help from your shop steward?
Well, yeah, I was really, it was tough. Okay, it's my first job. I just went to work in May.
And what year is this?
This is the year 2000.
Okay.
May 2000, I'm on this first job. At around the end of August, the shop steward, Jimmy, he gets laid off, finally. The union had been like trying to keep him going, but the company was like, look, the guy cannot be out every Wednesday. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just not appropriate. So they appointed somebody else. And the trouble I was having with this guy, Scott, is Scott would come into the locker area and he would just start changing his clothes right in front of me, but not right in front of me only, like just in front of everyone. Yeah. In fact, he would get up on a stage because we would have material stacked up in the room, pallets of marble. Mm-hmm. He would get on top of the skid and he would undo his pants and change his to his work pants. And other guys, since the locker is actually an apartment of the building, other guys would go into these other little rooms and do their thing. You know, and basically the main room, we would sit and have our coffee. So one guy said, hey, Scott, you know, Angela's in here. And he's like, so, you know, if she doesn't like it, she can leave. I was here first, he says. Mm-hmm. Meaning he thinks that because I was away at masonry camp, I wasn't on that job first. Mm-hmm. Whatever. Now, my strategy was this, and it's a strategy I offer, you know, to anyone, but we all have our own, you know, repertoire of response on these things. I just got in. I'm so focused on doing my work. I don't want to make an issue of Scott, because Scott is, you know, by me pointing any fingers at him, is going to make more dirt on my face than, you know, satisfaction of dealing with him.
Right.
So when Scott would do this thing, I would either step out of the locker or I'd turn my back. And, you know, that's the way that went. A little later into the year, around August, we had some overtime. I had a second coffee break with Scott and some of the other guys. And I ordered a soda. You know, people order juices and drinks. Scott orders a beer for second coffee break. And we were working in an area where there was a lot of people. So we went off into the smaller room, and I sat down on a skid, an empty skid. And Scott came over, and he sat right next to me, and he leaned on me. He leaned his disgusting, sweaty body on me. And I don't even know what he began to say out of his mouth, but I just turned to him, and I was like, get the fuck off me. Get the fuck off me. And, you know, I pulled my own body away from him. There was a guy sitting directly across from me, and he said, Scott, she don't like you, man. She don't like you. She don't like you. And Scott shifted his ass away. So, and that's how I dealt with that. But here, there's a pattern building here, okay, with me and Scott and his inappropriateness. We're having lunch on the street one day. And a vendor came along, and he had this little cardboard box, and he had batteries and cologne and belts, and he was selling stuff. And he came up to the bunch of us sitting on the sidewalk, and he's like, you know, selling his wares. And Scott jumps up and looks in the box, and the guy had the bottles of ginseng. So the guy says to Scott, you know, get the ginseng, and he motions like this with his fists, as if to say, you know, it'll arouse you.
Oh, yeah.
So Scott goes, oh yeah, and he motions back, and then he reaches down, he starts unzipping his pants, and he reaches in to take his penis out. I turn my head away.
Yeah.
The other guys I'm sitting with, like, I catch sight of one guy looking over in Scott's direction, and he's, like, appalled.
Yeah.
You know, Scott's, he's just being so embarrassing to all of us.
Right.
But the men are going to be like, oh, you know.
Right, they're not going to say anything.
Right. So I'm like, God damn, you know, why is this guy? It's disrespectful, basically.
Right.
Like, I'm not a prude, and I'm not, like, you know, going to be a Puritan about these things. I, as I tell women, this is not the choir of angels that you're joining.
It's a rough culture.
Yeah. But I just felt like, okay, Scott is really daring me to say, please don't take your penis out.
Right.
I'm not going to play into his hand.
Okay.
So in less than 1 week's time, we're on the street again. The whole building is on the street now. The whole construction site is on this one side by the food emporium, because they had a lunch buffet. It was great. We'd all be there eating our thing. And at this point in story, another woman has come to work on that job. Uh-huh. She's a helper. Her name is Chantel Bauer.
Uh-huh. And that's your
she's,
union.
She's in my union, yeah. Uh-huh. And so this is amazing. And I remember before this happened, but after the first time Scott took his penis out, she had come to me one afternoon and she was like, I just saw Scott's boxer shorts. I'm like, I know. He does this thing where he changes his clothes in front of you. So we're all on the street, and there's a pretty woman walking across the other street. I felt so bad for her because she made a wrong turn. On a hot summer day, she turned on the corner, and all the construction workers are sitting on the ground eating their food. So they all start catcalling, and Scott's like the master of ceremonies. He's screaming to her, "Are those real? Are those real? Are those real?" And she's trying to, be dignified and just walk. But finally she turns around and she grabs both her breasts and she shakes them at Scott and she goes, they're real, is that real? She says to him. He says, you want to know if it's really real? And he starts unzipping his pants, takes penis out again. I was so fed up. I just was so fed up. So I got up, I walked away, I went to a payphone. I didn't have a cell phone at the time. I called my apprentice coordinator, Phil Avrizano. I said, listen, I got a situation here. I said, because I felt so disappointed.
Yeah.
I'm like, there's other men in my local. There's other men on this job. Somebody, just say, Scott, listen, don't do that in front of her.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. Nobody steps up. So I called Phil. I said, look, Phil, I just want somebody to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I don't want to do it because that's what he wants me to do.
Yeah.
He wants me to come to him and say, please don't.
Yeah.
And psychologically, I'm not playing that game with him. So, and it's funny, on the phone, he's like, he took it all the way out? I'm like, Phil, does it matter?
It's not the first time. Yeah, but
right. So I return to work, and I'm with Chantal. And one of the other mechanics, this guy, his nickname is Cockeyed Gene, he comes to me and he says, that wasn't right what he did out there.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, you should call the union. I said, I've done it. He's like, all right. And he says, you and her, you should, together. I said, no, Gene. I said, if it was me and 100 other women, mm-hmm. it wouldn't be the same as if you
right.
just say something.
Right.
Just you, Gene, would mean everything.
Right.
And he's like, you're right. So, Phil shows up on my job with the business agent
mm-hmm.
for the tile mechanics. That was a guy named Eddie Solari. Eddie Solari was kind of like Mike Tyson. He was a big guy
uh-huh.
with a very soft voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he would always say, hey kid, how you doing? How you doing? Is everything all right? Okay, good. Eddie Solari showed up on this job, and he had a voice like I never heard. He was like, where is Scott? Like,
mm-hmm.
really gruff. And Gene took him on the side, and Gene explained, he was motioning like this,
nuts.
So Eddie found Scott. I wasn't with him, because Scott was on another floor working. And I was told, he said to Scott, take your tools, you're off the job.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Scott came running up the stairs. Mm-hmm. Eddie jumped between us, and Scott was screaming.
He was coming at you.
And he was crying,
mm-hmm.
tears in his eyes. You should have been a man. You should have said something to me. I never had any problem with the union, blah, blah, blah. He was really upset.
Mm-hmm.
And, he got it off his chest, but he was getting kicked off that job. And I appreciated that the union had to take this severe thing so that I wouldn't turn around and say, you didn't, do the right thing when they bothered me. It's a shame that it had to come to that
mm-hmm.
stage, but that just seems to the way it always goes.
Yeah. Well, so have you seen Scott since then?
I saw Scott about a year later
uh-huh.
at a union meeting.
Mm-hmm.
He walked right up to me.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm very sorry. I was an ass. I had to go to a hearing at the union. I had to pay a fine. I'm really sorry.
Wow.
Yes.
Progress in many ways.
Not only that, I heard a story through the grapevine mm-hmm. about Mr. Scott. Scott went to another job with another woman tile setter. Her mm-hmm. name is Rita. And a guy, a foreman on that job, was giving Rita trouble, and Scott stuck up for her.
Wow.
This was after his incident
uh-huh.
with me.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe
yeah.
Scott learned a big
uh-huh.
lesson.
I mean,
maybe he's an ally now, so it could be great.
Uh-huh. Terrific. Great. Okay, so now you go through this whole apprenticeship program, and how long did that last?
That lasted 3 years almost to the day.
Wow.
Yeah, but it was an interesting 3 years. Mm-hmm. In fact, I just got on November 20th, 20-something, uh-huh. I just got in the mail my certificate that says, this is to certify that Brother Angela Olszewski has completed, you know, all the training and required hours to be a journeyman mm-hmm. tile setter. And it's, to receive it now, it's a year and a half later. Mm-hmm. The date on the document is May 12th, 2003.
You didn't have a ceremony when you graduated?
No.
No ceremony?
No.
They just say, you're finished. And
yeah, I've seen them announce it at meetings, like, uh-huh. you know, because some people finish mm-hmm. up at different times, because mm-hmm. it's based on 4,500 hours of work, and mm-hmm. some of us do better than others, maybe maybe depending on our mm-hmm. race and gender. Uh-huh. You know, we do it quicker uh-huh. or slower. You know, so I've seen that happen with other people, but...
And how many classroom hours?
Classroom hours, it's 144 hours of related training per year of your apprenticeship.
And how were your instructors in the apprentice program? Did you still have Phil as an instructor?
No, in the election of 2001, Phil lost to the treasurer, and so then he lost his job, mm-hmm. and... This new guy, John Cosentini, stepped up to be the instructor, and he had to get it together, and I was really patient in the beginning. I cooperated with him. Phil did some things that weren't right, where when he exited, he didn't leave behind the paperwork.
So this is tape two, interviewing Angela Olszewski, and it's December 18th, and we're talking about her apprenticeship. So Angela, tell me about the new instructor who took over in the apprentice program.
Yeah, it's a guy named John Cosentini, and he comes out of the marble industry. He was the marble instructor at the time that I trained to be a tile setter during mm-hmm. that 12-week pre-job. Seemed like a nice enough guy then. But he fell flat for me as an apprentice coordinator. When I went to my next big job with Crescetti at the Ritz-Carlton in Battery Park City, mm-hmm. Things were great. There was a lot of opportunities for training there. Mm-hmm. And I was very, very diligent about keeping track of my skills and keeping track of the skills I needed to acquire. Mm-hmm. And really looking around, when I was on a job site, I'd be like, okay, I've never done that kind of installation. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to get some time trying mm-hmm. that. And the Ritz-Carlton had so many opportunities for me as an apprentice. And the foreman basically, after a while, he complimented me quite a bit, told me I had hands of gold, I was really good at tiles, at the marble setting, and... But what he did is he kind of pigeonholed me into this one particular project. And that's not uncommon. When you work on a big job, mm-hmm. you're gonna be the floor person, somebody else is going to be the hop-up right. person, somebody else is going to be the shower pin person. But as an apprentice, I need to try everything. Right. I can't really uh-huh.
And
do
that's
that.
Been a big problem for the women, to be sort of denied these other opportunities to learn.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and it's partly a sexism driven, and it's partly business driven mm-hmm. because he wants to run a job efficiently
right.
and he wants to make his bonuses mm-hmm. and things like that. So I was trying to, you know, do my best at playing politics mm-hmm. and figuring out, okay, when's a good time for me to ask him? Mm-hmm. And I asked the foreman a couple of times, please, 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 mm-hmm. you know, put me on another assignment so I can learn. And he would say to me things like, oh, I promise, I just really need you to finish up to this floor doing this particular project. Mm-hmm. And it was, he had me on this thing called backsplashes for quite a while. And it was actually an excellent opportunity. I'm not going to disregard mm-hmm. what I was learning from it and not appreciate it. I had to cut every piece of marble I installed, which is a good skill to develop. Mm-hmm. I also had to do intricate out corner and in corner miters with the marble chair rail. And where my work appeared, a backsplash, is right behind the sink, the bathroom sink. Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, you're in a hotel. How often do you look at every bit of the tile? You don't. You look in at certain areas. And one of those areas is going to be when you're washing your hands. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, well, this is great, you know. Mm-hmm. This is a really important mm-hmm. part of this project. And I held on to that as long as I could, and then I said, you know what, I need to get on the walls, because my apprenticeship is going to be over one of these years, mm-hmm. and if I don't have these skills, right. they're going to be like, kid, we don't have any more backsplashes right. for you.
Yeah.
So I asked him once, I asked him twice. The International Union, in the end of June, early July of 2001, invited me to the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. And my International Union was part of the exhibit called Masters of the Building Trades, Masters of the Building Arts, yeah. And so I was there at this exhibit, and I was installing tile, and people would walk through the exhibit, mm-hmm. and they'd ask you questions, and, you know, we all had our things to say, and mm-hmm. it was a wonderful experience. I spoke on a speaking stage about being a woman in the trades. Mm-hmm. And
were there some other women?
There were. There was a woman from Seattle, Washington. Shucks, I can't think of her name just in this moment.
Mm-hmm. What was her trade?
She was a tile setter okay. as well. Mm-hmm. Colleen Muldoon, who is the director of education at IMI, she was a bricklayer for 8 years. She was there doing brick installation. That was it for the women,
uh-huh.
yeah.
Yeah.
But they had, you know, men of color. Mm-hmm. We really, you know, we looked very politically correct
uh-huh.
on this stage mm-hmm. in, you know, the nation's capital. And that's when I realized, like, there's a lot of facade. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of facade.
And it's not just on the buildings.
yeah, and it's not just on the buildings. So I did that, and I was very proud to do that, and mm-hmm. I was paid handsomely to do that, mm-hmm. and returned back to the Ritz-Carlton. But I returned back to the Ritz-Carlton with an agenda mm-hmm. that I was moving on from the backsplashes. Mm-hmm. And while I was at the Folklife Festival for almost 2 weeks, I spoke to the president of my local. And he asked me, how's it going? Mm-hmm. And I said, things are going good, except, you know, I want to move on to these walls. Right. He says, all right, well, when you get back, if things don't change, mm-hmm. let me know. So I start working with John Cosentini. Mm-hmm. And I said, listen, John, can you please come and talk to this woman?
Intervene.
You know? Mm-hmm. So he shows up, and I was doing floors on the day he showed up. And John says to me, you know, Angela, I don't want to burn your bridges. And I scratch my head and I say, what is this burning my bridges?
Yeah.
I'm an apprentice. He's a foreman. You're a man. We talk. Right. We say, this is good for business. This is good for the union. This is good for me. This is good for you as the coordinator. I need to get my skills.
Right.
We need to make a plan here. Right. There's so much that I could be doing.
Right.
And it was as if to speak to this foreman and say, can this apprentice, no matter what, if I had purple polka dots, you know,
yeah.
let the purple polka dotted apprentice.
He's the union.
Yeah, he's in my union, the coordinator's in my union,
yeah.
I'm in the union, you know, this is an apprenticeship.
You're asking for help from your union.
Yeah.
So you expect it.
Yeah. And he said, I don't want to burn your bridges. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, And right there, I lost complete faith in John Cosentini. I was like, you know what? I've been doing this better on my own, and I will continue to do it better on my own. So I let him walk away that day, and I went home, and I looked at all my paperwork, and I wrote down all the different tasks that I've been doing. And I have this paperwork. I have every fax, every letter I've ever written. And in a very, very nice way, I said, to the union, to the company, to the foreman, to the coordinator, to my business agent, to the international, and to the IMI, which is the affiliation of the International. I said, gentlemen and brothers, you know, here's how it's going. I've been on this job. This is a marvelous job. There's so many opportunities for me. I'm doing this backsplash thing. I'm learning so much from it. I said, but let me give you a breakdown of the spectrum of my experience so far and the skills I think I need to, you know, spend some time with. And I wrote, and I put it in plain English. I said, I spent 43 days on backsplashes, 38 days on punch lists, 14 days on the floors, and 8 days on walls. It was, like, dramatic, you know? Like, the backsplash and the punch list together was, you know, 6 months of nothing. So I you know, complimented the foreman. I said, you know, he's obviously one of the best foremen the company has. This is a very big, expensive job. I'm glad to be here. Not trying to burn any bridges. Well, my strategy was, I would always, the night before, I'd fax it to everybody at once. So in the morning, they're all on the same page, my page. And when it hit the fan, Charlie Hill, the president of my local, called GM Crescetti, the shop. When I walked in, the foreman said, you're upset. The shop called me. I'm like, I'm not upset. There's nothing to be upset about. I told you I need to move on. You know, I know you're trying to keep track of this as a business, you know, but I'm trying to keep track of it as an experience. And not that day, but the next day I went on the walls. And unfortunately, that was the end of August, and September 11th was September 11th.
And that was the end of the Ritz-Carlton for a while.
For a little while, yeah. But I remember I just got on walls, and I remember the guy came to take coffee order, and he came back in a few minutes, and I knew it was too soon for him to be back. And he said, Angela, you got to see this, you got to see this. And I remember coming around, and a bunch of us were in a room just looking from south of the towers, just looking at what was going on, and the second jet flew over our building. I mean, it was like, I thought the thing was going to crash into the back of my head from the sound. We couldn't even see it because we were looking at the towers. But I remember us all, like, it was so primordial what happened, like the way our bodies were like, oh, because that jet was so low. And that guy really gunned it when he went down the street. So that was a tremendous experience. And we returned to work October 1st after that. And I stayed on walls, but then I had some really big problems. The guys had put up porn, and there was beer cans and porn all over the locker when I returned. Because a small group of men went back to work a week before the rest of us. And I thought it was really inappropriate because, I mean, the porn was on the wall and Ground Zero was out the window. It was just like that. So I walked up to the porn and I took it down. I said, you know, who the fuck put this up? I said, you know, you should put this on your mother's grave. And, you know, guys were snickering. As it turned out, I didn't know because it's so shady. One of the guys in the room was a shop steward. Never announced it to me, never told me in like all the months that I've been there.
Well kept secret.
Yeah, well kept secret. And this is my first day back after 9/11. So I take this down. I'm very upset. I call the outside guy. I had just been appointed to the Women's
Task
Force.
For
Crescetti.
For Crescetti.
Yeah, he's like the guy that assigned you some work. I had just been appointed to the International Women's Task Force, and, you know, came back and boom, there's this. And I put it in my pocket, and what I started to do when men would show up for work that morning, I would open it in front of their face, in my hand, and I'd say, do you know who put this up? I'd like to talk to them. And the guys were like, they were just running for the hills. Finally, I opened it up and I showed it to the foreman. I said, do you know who put this up? I want to talk to them. He said, no one did that to bother you. No one did that to bother you. I only had men here last week. They needed to have a good time. I said, good time, yeah? Good time? What about my good time? You know, and there was a lot of shadiness.
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 Second time you've said that. What do you mean?
I mean that, so there was this week before mm-hmm. where men were there working. Mm-hmm. And then this October 1st, where me and some other fellas showed up for work, because we were told that's when we could return.
Right. But why were the other guys there?
Why were the other guys there, we wondered. Uh-huh. And, you know, we're talking about going back to work and earning. And I, that afternoon, I called President Hill and I explained to him what happened. He apologized to me immediately on the phone. He said, I'm very sorry that that happened. And I said, thank you, you know,
I realized. He's president of the international.
No, of the local.
Of the local, okay.
Right, of the local.
Oh, that's right, Billy Hill's dad.
Billy Hill's dad. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, try to find out who was there the week before. Mm-hmm. And I said, can't you find out? And he and I started talking on the phone a mm-hmm. bit. Over the days that followed, and he said the shop wouldn't tell him who was there.
Wow.
And I'm saying to myself, there's got to be a way to know.
Yeah.
You call the benefit office, yeah. were their benefits paid for that week, or payroll, something.
Yeah.
You, what about your shop stewards, you know, sitting there laughing? And it was a very deep, dark episode after 9/11, because I stayed on that job until December. And I was having all this hostility, because what it boiled down to, and it's so strange, every man on that job received a letter from the union saying that they had to show up, that they might be brought up on charges. Every one of them. And not every one of them did it.
Yeah.
Some of those guys didn't come back till October 1st, so they weren't part of the deal.
Yeah.
But the way the union handled it, the way the local handled it, they said, okay, we're bringing everybody in. Why? Because the guys that were there the week before couldn't be man enough to say, you know, who it was.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they want to say it's my fault that I'm making
right.
a fuss.
Right.
And I'm not going to back down. I'm not going to play like, you know,
oh,
call
right.
the police, I'm being abused. No, you know, I changed my mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we went through this. And at the end of November, I had to go to the facility where they have the training, because that was big enough for us to do this thing. And all the guys that I worked with on that job site had to go. And they took my testimony first, and I was told when my testimony was over, leave, don't come back, just go straight home,
mm-hmm.
as if I should be afraid
yeah,
for myself.
That's scary.
And I was told that I would not be allowed to know what the determination was. I don't understand that.
Yeah, right.
That I was not going to be allowed. And John Cosentini, who is my apprentice coordinator, and at the time he was the person assigned to be the contact for sexual harassment.
Mm.
Well, don't you know, when I sit down for that hearing, he's one of the judges. And I said, this is a conflict here, right here. You have too many hats
mm-hmm.
that this guy's wearing. And he had this like bogus stack of yellow manila folders,
mm-hmm.
bogus. They had scribble on them. He had a stack of them. And he said, see this, Angela? All these men are going to get a letter in their file, you know, from this. And he wanted me to show him the porn because I had it with me. I'm like, all right. And he looked at it. And it was just ridiculous. It was ridiculous that I wasn't allowed to know
yeah.
what the outcome was. And I, you know, basically had to keep going to work,
mm-hmm.
staying on walls. Now, I'm trying to get a new skill.
Right, right.
I'm trying to learn this new skill, and I have this, you know, tension.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, out the window is ground zero.
And you were working with different men, or working paired up with one person? Or you basically work by yourself?
Basically, I work by myself.
Uh-huh.
I need to be set up by another person.
Uh-huh.
And he usually will set up two people,
uh-huh.
so he'll, like, if I'm doing marble, he'll load up the room I'm working in with marble, he'll give me a bucket of thin set, maybe by coffee break he'll give me another bucket of thin set, you know, depending
mm-hmm.
on how the installation's going.
So you ended that job in December.
Yeah.
And you never found out what the resolution of the, and even what was happening with the Women's Committee?
In
the task force.
Well, in January of 2002, I approached the local. I said, listen, you know, I got put on this task force. I would like to write a letter to all the women in the local and announce it and say, hey, you know, here's my contact information. Contact mm-hmm. me, you know, maybe we can talk. And I wrote this letter and I went down to the local because the only way you can get members' information, you know,
yeah.
is through the local and you can't really have it personally.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Did they ever tell you how many women were in the local?
We came up with a list of about 20 names.
Okay.
And when I first showed up, it was just me and President Hill. And he was looking through these, you know, the old-fashioned computer paper with the holes
oh, yeah.
and the green and white bars.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, I don't know how to use the computer. Let's see if we can find these women. And he was going to leaf through like 1,500 names.
Mm-hmm.
And he was trying to do this. And I was like, mm. you know, and somebody else came in who knew how to work the computer. And they punched out mm-hmm. the women names. And in fact, some of the guys came out because they were missed, you know,
yeah.
tabulated as women,
uh-huh.
and they fixed that.
God help us.
Yeah. And so I had this list. So then I had my letter, and I said, okay, here, you know, you can read this and let me know if it has your blessing. I'm not gonna have any close fists here. Like, here you go.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know what you think. So he took it away, and he came back. And he's looking at it. And at the bottom, I put a little tear off. I was enclosing a self-addressed stamp
so
envelope.
You can hear from
yeah,
people.
Just
right.
filling it. And
makes sense.
And he came back and he was like, oh, I said, you know, listen, this can't be anything political. I said, it's not going to be political. I said, maybe we'll get together and have dinner. We'll invite you. You know, like,
yeah.
this is just a letter of introduction, really. And he was so worried about the politics. Well, sadly, I got a response from, like, three women, two that I already knew, and one woman flat out was like, I don't, you know, just don't worry about me, forget about me. And I'll tell you that it's mostly white women.
Uh-huh.
And my experience of white women in the trades, because I don't see them a lot at Coffee House and even at OPL,
uh-huh.
is there's a feeling of like you carve your niche and you protect yourself. You know, and it's sad, but really, like, I think we're the ones that really need to help, you know, face some of the racism that's aligned with sexism.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't take off, this
mm-hmm.
women's committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew, too, that in my local, whether it was me with the women's committee
mm-hmm.
or anybody doing anything outside of that loop,
mm-hmm.
that if you align yourself with others like me, you're not going to work, and you want to take those hits, you know, and that's the truth. You will be,
and why
it won't be work for you.
Why align? I mean, why so soon in your history in that union? Just because to do anything is to.
Well,
I mean, why? The union has asked you to do this. Your international has asked.
Well, the international didn't say, okay, we want you on the task force. Here's a handbook on what to do.
No, right.
I took it upon myself.
You took some initiative.
Absolutely.
I mean, what is the task force supposed to do?
The mission is to give policy suggestion for the better recruitment and retention of women in the BAC trades.
And one of the keys to retention is that women can have access to each other and know that they even are there and have a way to talk to each other and help each other survive, and that's one of the basic
exactly.
ideas of retention.
Exactly.
So
reduce the feeling of isolation,
mm-hmm.
you know,
being the only
foster
one.
Support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but that's too threatening for the, yeah.
Yeah.
So what has this, I hate to use this unfortunate expression, but I will. I just can't help it. Has this petered out, this task force, or?
Well, I would say I'm kind of disappointed, and I think, you know, some of it I realize has to do with the politics of the international really can't intervene in the locals' politics.
Right.
that's just the way it's mm-hmm. set up, you know, like the state and federal government, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And Charlie said to me that day, he said, you were not elected. This is an appointment, mm-hmm. you know, so he's making it clear to me. And I respect if you've honestly been elected to anything, you've been elected, you know. But, you know, snowball chance in hell that, you know, we're going to get women elected and doing anything anytime soon. So the International did this, and it makes the International look good, mm-hmm. which I realized.
To have it.
Yeah, to say, here it is, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And that's why I was saying things seem like facade. So we have a task force, and you can say you're doing something about getting women into the trades. But I just say to them all, phooey, you know. I've had enough of meetings. I've had enough of mm-hmm. more women's organizations. Mm-hmm. You just need to hit the trenches. You mm-hmm. need to go out in the field, and you need to say to the GM Crescettis and the Port Morrises and the other tile companies and brick companies and whoever, women are here, give them a fair apprenticeship, you know, give them a fair year's worth of work hours, and, you know, it'll happen. Mm-hmm. And you know, put some guards up against this hostile workplace experiences and sexual harassment, and it'll be fine. But nobody wants to do that work. Mm-hmm. It's so wonderful to be academic. Oh, I'll write this, you know, thing about, but it's got to be in the trenches. There's got to be
one thing
point
that
guards, you
it
know?
Never comes down to the workplace.
Right.
Angela, let's switch to talking about your status as a journey person. What happened in terms of getting work after you became a journey level? And how much did your salary go up? I mean, your hourly rate. What is your hourly rate?
Right now, my hourly rate is $39.87, and that's just my paycheck.
And then you have your benefits hanging into your...
I have it in my pocket. Do you want me to get it?
I hope it's not a lethal weapon. Okay, so we're switching to the paycheck.
Yes. So currently, we just got a raise. And I'm up to, $39.85 an hour.
Uh-huh.
And my annuity is up to $7 an hour, which is, it's great for tile. There's a pension as well, and, you know, I cannot complain one bit. I've never paid anything out of pocket, really, mm-hmm. and, you know.
And so are you working for one contractor now?
Well, I spent my first 2 years with GM Crescetti, which, remember, Phil said,
yes.
you know, it's a rough
Don't
job.
Don't burn your bridges. And it's, oh,
well,
yeah.
Costantini
well, was,
said
yeah.
not to burn my
right.
bridges. But,
okay.
You know, the bottom line is I hung with that shop
right.
my first
uh-huh.
2 years, and I did a good job. I know I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a question. And I knew when I was given the opportunity to do production work,
mm-hmm.
where I described to you,
right.
four a day or three
uh-huh.
a day or whatever,
and
I could get up to that speed.
Uh-huh.
Now, what would happen is the foreman, no sooner do I touch, you know, that number, he's like, okay, I need you to do this
uh-huh.
now. So it was like, oh, you know, I wanted to hang and do
yeah.
it for a little
right.
while to really be confident. But it's all right. It all comes to you over time. It,
uh-huh.
it really builds up. And then I spent the next 2 years, I had a little layover. I had that incident in Ritz-Carlton.
Uh-huh.
I got laid off in December. I was out of work till just about April.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. But at that point, the thing is, whenever I have time down
mm-hmm.
is when I jump into my organizing.
Okay.
So I got hooked up with TNT
mm-hmm.
in that layover
and you're
in
on
2002.
The, what do you call it, the board?
I'm not on
you're
the board.
Not.
I did get elected to the board
mm-hmm.
of directors. And I gave it my best shot, but still being an apprentice and
trying,
you know,
to get to
not feeling the support
to,
from my local,
uh-huh.
my international has always really tried to throw money at me in terms of funding a trip here and there, but they weren't on board to fund me full time for that position, and I really couldn't do it. I think the next meeting was somewhere remote that I couldn't really get to. I couldn't take the time off of my apprenticeship and so on. So I resigned from the board, but you know, felt good about stepping up and giving it a try and learning from that experience. And my international did support me to go to other events with TNT.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, in April of that year, was it April? Yes, because that's how I went back to work. I went to the Building and Construction Trades Council meeting in D.C., and I met Senator Clinton and introduced her and her staff to TNT and our mission and gave them some paperwork, and I shook her hand. I have a nice photo. And she really, picked up the ball and has been running with the tradeswomen issue. She put a resolution out for tradeswomen. I'll pass that along to you, Jane. And she invited us back the following year and sponsored us for a luncheon. But that was an incredible experience to go and see all the presidents of all the internationals in the building trades, painters, elevators, electricians.
And what has come of that? Because it was talking about retention and getting women in and keeping women in. What's come of that? Has there been follow-through?
Okay, with the Women's Task Force.
Not with your union. I'm talking about with TNT meeting with the heads of all these unions. Because I remember that meeting that you went to.
That invitation alone was a big icebreaker because till then...
I mean, it only took 25 years.
Right.
But, okay, so you were... I remember hearing about that. You were all there. You told them the issues. You had... materials.
Yes, it was very positive. It was a positive first step. And we had a table set up. It was the first time the BCTD invited a national tradeswomen organization to an event like that.
Historic, big.
Yeah.
So and I want to know about the follow-up.
Well, basically,
because
there are information tables.
Again.
I'm sure they are.
They are.
Yes,
I looked on the TNT
I'm sure they are
calendar.
Because it went well for everyone. We handed out materials. So a guy from a local in Wisconsin would come to us, and we'd say, there's a tradeswomen organization in this city, in that state. Hook up with them. Just like. There's New and there's Chicago Women in Trades. There's others.
Sure, right.
And we basically were trying
able
to network
to,
the locals with the women's organizations. And, we all felt good about that. It was positive. Lauren Sugarman gave a presentation as well with some other tradeswomen.
So, side B of tape two. So continue. So we're talking about TNT.
Yeah, TNT at the Building Trades Conference in 2002 in D.C. And, Lauren gave a presentation, and it just went really well. And for me, what was interesting is the members of the officers of my local were there. Because officers of all locals, like it's just a big, powwow for the international trade unions. And, what was just incredible, it was shocking to me how many, overweight, balding, older white men were there. I mean, I thought, we were talking about cloning recently.
Well, this is the building and construction trades.
I said to myself, they've been cloning people for years. All these people look alike. I can't believe it. I mean, I'm sorry, however that has just come out, but I mean, that there was no real diversity.
No, that's the history of the building.
It was really shocking, and I've had some women come over to me and say, I know, just relax, relax, because it was so shocking.
But did people ask questions when Lauren spoke?
Yes, yes. People wanted to know, basically, how to make all of this work better.
Wow.
Positive people, that would... one that would come to
girls
the...
Girls don't want to be in the trades.
Right.
We tried that.
Yeah, well, those guys are probably at the bar instead of at the, you know, presentation. But I did see the officers of my own local.
Okay.
And, you know, my international and the task force, particularly Colleen Muldoon, was aware that I'd been out of work since the Ritz-Carlton. And my business agent was there. Yeah, it was a long time. And my business agent was there. And he said, you know, make sure you call me when you get back. And I'm like, all right. You know, and I called him. He's like, all right, you're back. And they're like, you know I'm out of work.
Right.
And I had been going to related training as an apprentice every week. And many of us were out of work. And we were just like, you know, we're out of work. Like, there was no, like, you don't know or any business like that. So, yeah, go to Washington, high profile, go back to New York, go back to work. And that's when I hooked up with Port Morris. Now, Port Morris is the other big shop. Port Morris is the other shop that hustles. That's, you know, it's tough to hang with them. And I hung with them for 2 years until recently. I really was with this company and, you know, was told things like, you always have a home here, and they made me a foreman on a project.
So what happened? You, all of a sudden, you don't have a home here?
Well, I was at the Brooklyn Federal Courthouse, and I was really shocked. That job was over 85% done by the time I was placed there. And I thought, my God, you know, why wasn't I here sooner? You know, I'm a woman, this is a federal project, you know. And it was a stone job, a thin set job. But whatever, I did my best and I did what I had to do. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as the time goes by, as the pages of the calendar turn, Jane, you know, I start to see more and more about what's going on here. And I was having a talk with some of the fellas, and we're really upset because we have a very shaky excuse for an annuity statement.
Mm-hmm.
So we're all worried, like, where's our money? What's it doing? Mm-hmm. How come we don't have a real financial statement?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if your bank gave you the piece of paper that I get that says, you know, what my annuity is, you'd be like, this isn't a real bank. there's a lot. And you know, there was somebody there who was also kind of a rabble-rouser, an African-American guy. And I said, you know, I'm starting to think that this is a boss's union. You know, I said, you know, Port Morris jobs, there's never any shop stewards on a Port Morris job. You know, and sure, Port Morris is the kind of company that always bends the rules a little, get a little more out of you, you know. Make a helper. A helper's only supposed to help two mechanics. Make them help three. Mm-hmm. Make them help five. You know, cut the corners.
You're lucky you're working.
It's be lucky you're working, or you'll do it like that and you'll work all year.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Okay. And people accept it.
Right, and people accept it, and they bring down the quality of
some
life for everyone.
People shape. But they do it anyway. They feel frustrated, but they're still going along with that program.
Right.
And so here you come, and you're saying,
yeah,
this isn't a good program.
Right. And one of the things that happened to me after I topped out, and I topped out with Port Morris, and I mean I got my journeyman book. I had been an apprentice with this guy, Joe Brocco. Joe Brocco has been a tile setter for 41 years, God bless him.
Mm-hmm.
41 years on his knees doing this work. That's incredible. But Joe Brocco was really a grouchy guy.
Uh-huh.
People were like, oh my God, he's so nasty, he's so this, he's so that. I became the apple of his eye, okay? Because I looked him in the eye one of these times when he was being grouchy to me, and I said, you remind me of my mother. And he laughed. He said, your mother must be a nice person. I said, she is. She really is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I called him out on his his bravado. But anyway, he still was all nasty to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And people, I guess, were getting upset that he liked me.
Mm-hmm.
But he ran a job really well. Like, I didn't have any problems with what I call soft discrimination. And what I mean by that is, I'm a full-paid journeyman. They want me to do 3 bathrooms a day. I want that helper to set me up.
Right.
Like, I'm going to do my 3 bathrooms. And what they would do is they say, oh, it's a woman. She's probably only going to do two. So then when I need the things I need to keep going, to keep flowing.
Not there.
Yeah, not there. And that started to happen.
Okay.
And really, when Joe retired and I was kind of with these other foremen,
mm-hmm.
I saw a lot of that. One of the things that happened in this contract
mm-hmm.
is before this contract, the helpers and the mechanics, tile setters,
mm-hmm.
we made very close money, very similar.
Mm-hmm.
And now, like I said, we're almost $9 away,
mm-hmm.
pulled away from them.
Mm-hmm.
Because we deserve it, Jane. We
yeah.
do a higher skill
right.
than they
yeah.
do.
Mm-hmm.
We're responsible
no more,
for the...
You have to,
yeah, we're
yeah.
responsible for how the job comes out. We're responsible to tell the helper what to do.
Yeah.
They don't tell us what to do, we
right.
tell them.
Mm-hmm.
We tell them, get us more, do this, get a bucket
mm-hmm.
of water, whatever. So we're starting to break away. Now you got to understand, there's guys that have been helpers for 15, 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And they're unhappy.
And suddenly, I'm a woman, and I'm making almost $10 an hour more than they are.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like it.
Right. So they're going to sabotage you.
Sabotage, just be jealous, call the shop, oh,
mm-hmm.
you know, this, that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a guy tell me that a foreman called the shop and said the reason something didn't get done was because I didn't do something. And it wasn't true. And the guy came to me telling me, he's like, listen, watch out for that foreman. Because he just, I heard him. And
mm-hmm.
he said this to
yeah.
to the shop.
Mm-hmm.
And it ain't right, it ain't right. And I'm like, okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And from about that moment on, I really just started to not worry so much. Like, oh my God, I got to do this, I got to
mm-hmm.
do that. And I started to just watch people.
Mm-hmm.
And watch how this one doesn't really... do it all either. And there's this one foreman. He screwed up so many times. He screwed up a layout. If he screws up a layout and I'm a mechanic and me and these other mechanics have to start a floor, but we have to stop now and rearrange the layout,
mm-hmm.
you think he's going to call the boss and say, I screwed up? He's going to say, no, the mechanics, they were too slow. You know, whether it's me or anybody.
Right.
So I started to realize, oh, wow, look at all these backstabbers.
Yeah.
You know, the guys that'll help three guys and four guys
mm-hmm.
instead of what the union says
mm-hmm.
is two.
And there's no
and
union
started,
presence.
Right.
There's nobody's enforcing it.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also, I wanted you to talk a little bit about what did it mean when you were made a foreman?
It was a very small job.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of happened in two places. That guy Joe Brocco retired. And he retired when this one job was really at completion. There were
mm-hmm.
a few apartments left to do. The crew was scaled down to me and two and three other people at a time. And basically, since I had been on the job so long, I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
I understood what had to be done. And it was really just wrapping it up. This other job, where I actually have a check stubs that
mm-hmm.
say foreman's pay, it's only $50 extra a week. Was a very small job. It was me and a helper.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2 days into the job, they sent another mechanic who I said, okay,
mm-hmm.
tile this bathroom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he did it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the limit of it. I didn't really run a crew.
Mm-hmm.
There was no shop steward there, obviously. We're all on our,
mm-hmm.
you know, our own reconnaissance
mm-hmm.
to speak up or say anything, but it was such a little job, and it was over in
okay. So then
days.
you were quickly laid off after you started speaking about the absence of the union presence, or
not quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I was on that job. I would have to look at my records. I'm going to say I was on that job in August. I was at this other job in September, shifted,
mm-hmm.
and. Laid off from that job on September 17th, and I was told lack of work,
mm-hmm.
and I called Port Morris every week for 3 weeks after that.
Yeah.
No work, no work, no work.
They don't want you back.
Called the union, said, put me on the list,
mm-hmm.
and no work, no work, no work.
Mm-hmm.
At the very end of November, I called my benefit office. I said, listen, do I have enough work hours for medical for next year? And they said, no. I said, whoa, and I called Port Morris,
mm-hmm.
and I said, you know, listen, I'm kind of hanging out here by a thread.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you don't have any federal projects? You know, I had never, ever, like, challenged them
right.
on that.
Mm-hmm.
But they were like, Angela, you know, you're not the only one. Because basically the benefit office was telling me I was going to do COBRA next year. I'm like, there's going to be a lot of press about this, you know. I'm going to do COBRA. I'm in a union. And, you know, so the guy at Port Morris was like, there's no work. And I wrote a letter to my business agent. And I said, I just want to remind you that on October 8th, I called you to be put on the out of work list. I said, I'm still out of work. And I called the benefit office and they said, I don't have my hours for medical. You know, could you please help me out with these matters? And I mailed that letter to him, to the president of the local, to the president of the international, to the head of the women's task force, to the benefit office, to Vinnie DeLazaro, the owner of Port Morris. And I blind CC'd it to Clinton's office, to TNT, and to Legal Momentum.
And what happened?
And very interesting synchronicity. I mailed the letter on Wednesday. Thursday morning, Legal Momentum called me, Francois. She said, Angela, I wonder if you can help us. We're looking at the Brooklyn courthouse, and we're having trouble with two contractors, this company Aztec and Port Morris, and they're not in compliance. And they have all these hours logged in October, and they're telling us they can't find any women, there's no women.
Oh, interesting.
And I said, wow, I said, that's really incredible, because I just mailed out this letter, you're gonna see in the mail in a couple of days. I just called Port Morris on Monday, they told me there's no work. La-di-da. And sure enough, I mailed my letter Wednesday. My business agent had it by Thursday, and he called me. And, you know, I told Legal Momentum, I said, you know, he called me, I'm going to call him back and, you know, see what's up. So I talked to him on the phone, and he says, listen, you have your benefit. I was out on disability this past year, 9 weeks. He said, you get credit. You get 35 hours credit for all your weeks. And we added up 9 times 35.
You hurt your hand on the job?
Yes, I hurt my hand on the job trying to speed up and do my work so that I could stay with Port Morris. That's another story. So I had the coverage. So I said, so how's it going with the out of work list? He said, well, you know, you must know it's been real slow.
Right.
He says, I don't have it in front of me, but I think you're number 10 or 11 on the list. I'm like, all right, well, you know, you let me know. He's like, yeah, you know, do me a favor, call me every week. I'm like, all right. So I call Legal Momentum, I tell them, you know, he didn't offer me a job, but, you know, I have these benefits. We're all like relieved. I go to the deli on the corner because I was going to stay home and prepare a legal intake with Legal Momentum. And I get a call at the grocery store there, and it's my business agent. And he says, you know, you're really lucky. The last 9 people I called didn't want to go to work. Do you want to go to work? I said, of course. I'm not going to say no. Of course, send me to work. So he gives me the information, boom, I have a job. I go to this job, it's with a new company called Wilkstone, and it's a place called Bliss Spa. Very high-end, very fancy spa. And I work Friday, 2 hours overtime. I work Saturday. I work Sunday. And like right there, I made a week's pay. So I'm thrilled, and on Saturday and Sunday, I did what's called float and cover. It's a tough thing to do in my trade, and we have parameters, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I was setting, Jane, the biggest, heaviest tile that tile setters in the union are allowed to set.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was a 2-foot by 2-foot stone. It was 3/4 of an inch thick.
Mm-hmm.
It was huge. And I had to set it on a floor with cement where we float it and we tap it in and then you set the next one next to it and so on and so forth. And I tell you, if I looked at all my worksheets, I've never done that before. Never, never. So here I'm thinking, wow, this company is so nice. They're paying me time and a half and double time to do this work. This is so great.
What happened?
It was fine. The foreman, the foreman with kid gloves, he's like, your work is so great. Oh my God, you've done that already, blah, blah, blah. It's just really
so
been
treating you
very
good.
Pleasant.
So
I worked on the job, there were two African-American guys, there were three Latin guys.
Wow.
It was like, this is such a breath of fresh air, this company.
So different.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
Okay, pleased. That's a good place to segue to. I want to quickly run through your ideas on, you know, what do you think are the most important things in terms of success for women? And, you know, all that, you know, all the organizing you're doing, the League of Momentum, TNT, what are the key things, the most important things?
For like conditions or?
Well, to
I would say for the women to be very determined.
Okay.
Very, very determined to do this. And I think that Nude does a good job, and I think it can do a better job in explaining the big picture to women, because we can't just say these are great jobs, you're going to get great money and great benefits. We need to say there's organized crime that tries to steal your pension and your annuity. There's, you know, shakiness on who gets to work and who doesn't, and you need to be, you know, in real life, you need to make plans for that.
Mm-hmm.
Even if, you know, you decide to make a federal case about it, you know what, if you're not getting your paycheck, you need to be ready to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we need to not paint such a rosy picture.
Right.
You know, I think that's just, you know, a good conscience will do that.
Yeah.
I think that the unions and the contractors, I would like to educate the men, particularly the men who are so proud. They say, you know, my father did this, his father did this, his father before him did this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's really nothing wrong with being proud of that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and to feel like, you know, you have an integral part of this. But you need to realize that on some level, that's a type of affirmative action. You know, that you are just entitled to come into this business.
Ownership.
Yeah.
Because, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, and to realize, like, you know, because men will want to say, oh, you know, why should we give the women special treatment?
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, well, because you must realize that you are receiving special treatment.
Mm-hmm.
You are not being put through what I am. You are being treated differently and better,
mm-hmm.
you know, with
right.
access to skills and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I had a young fella who I watched him go from being a helper to training to be a mechanic, and now he's a foreman on jobs. And I'm watching how, because he's one of the insiders, you know, he's getting opportunities to do, you know, things like train to be a foreman. No one trained me. The union didn't offer me training. The company didn't say, okay, you know what, we'll warm you up and let you work with a foreman and then make you a foreman. You know, there's none of that. It was just like, go ahead, you know, just throw you in. And whereas this kid, I saw him working with someone who's very respected as a foreman. And I had a confrontation with him. He was on my job when I was a foreman. And I said to him, you know, I was kind of disappointed. I said, the one day you left at 1:30 and you didn't even finish the shower stall. And he says, oh, well, you know, what were you going to do the next day if I didn't leave you that work? I'm like, what is that? I said, you and I work for Port Morris. We work 7 hours a day. Joe's the outside guy. Joe tells me, you know, 7 hours. You know, I thought you finished that shower. You didn't even finish it. He turned around, he says to me, you got some set of balls talking to me like that. I should smash your fucking head, he says. And he said it in front of this other guy. And I turned to the other guy, I said, look at this, he's going to smash my fucking head, you know? And he realized, like, he just got furious because he's just so entitled. He's so entitled to be there, and he's so, like, you know, this is his space, not mine, and, you know? And he walked away, and he cooled off, and he came back, and he was nervous because he realized he
screwed up.
He screwed up bad. And he says, you know, listen, I got nothing against you. He's like, anyone ever talks to me about you? I say, she's a hard worker. I said, this is, you know, he says, this is just between me and you. I said, well, let me ask you something. I said, did you have to wait in line to get into this union? He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, seriously, did you have to fill out a piece of paper and take a test and wait? And, you know, the answer is obviously no.
Right.
You know, his father's in the union, and when it was time, his father worked for Paul Morris or wherever, and they said, okay, you're in. I said, well, you know, some of us, like me, you know, we really had to keep proving it to people and all that. And, you know, he kind of like tried to, you know, back away from all this,
yeah.
You know, like he respected me and this and that. But it just really disgusted me because I realized, you know, I'm not going to ever have the access that he has
mm-hmm.
to this trade. To
that
be,
you love.
Right. Right.
Tell me about your ideas about women going into the trades, into construction. I mean, do you think it's a good fit? I mean, what do you think?
Oh yeah, I think we're just dealing with a particular population of individuals in the unions and in contracting who just have some old-fashioned ideas and some control issues. Where they just want to keep this little thing to themselves because
it's a good thing.
It's very lucrative for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The officers in my local make six digits. They get new cars, like. But and it's fine, you know. I was told by John Cosentini that President Hill is a respected president. Of a local, you know, all over the country he's respected. And I'm like, well, what about right here? How about these annuity statements, you know? Like,
yeah.
How about the respect right here? So, you know, for the women, I think we really just got to let them know, like I really love all that I've learned. And I really love the confidence that it has given me
mm-hmm.
in all of the world and in all of life, like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to go in and hang with these guys, a lot of them have, you know, criminal records and, you know, it's a rough bunch to navigate, to get my skills to perform. It's a performance thing, you know what I mean? You gotta have your nerve, you gotta have your wit, you gotta, you know, I work on my knees on top of that. For most of my 7 hours is on my knees. And, you know, I do my work and I love my work. But I think if somehow we could really just make sure women have access to the skills they need, real access, not like, oh yeah, we'll let you try this once. No. It's a 4,500-hour apprenticeship. Let's make a plan. It's that simple. It's so easy. And you all make your six-digit figures or your 52 checks a year that you have the time to make a map. I mean, I could do it. And you, Jane, and me, and you see all the women who are active. We don't have extra salaries to do this.
Mm-hmm.
We're all doing it in our own time and, you know, for our own passion. And I see some of these guys just sitting on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you devote a lot of your time to activism, organizing on behalf of women in the trades, and I'm wondering, what are your goals? What are your dreams when you think of your first year career? Do you have some
okay.
dreams?
I do. I am applying to law school.
Oh.
Yes, and I want to do labor law, and I'm going to keep my book. See, a lot of people
yeah.
think, oh, you're,
yeah.
no, I'm not moving out.
I didn't think that for one second.
Well, I knew you wouldn't. I knew you wouldn't because, you know, we have a connection. And it's unfortunate, but I think I'm going to give a go. In my third year of law school, we'll coincide with the next election in my local,
uh-huh.
and I want to throw my name in the hat.
Wow.
I want to run on
and
the platform
really
that
campaign.
The union deserves a lawyer for president, you know, like somebody who's going to
yeah.
give them back,
mm-hmm.
and it's not just bravado. And you
it
know,
it takes a lot of guts. Angela, do you think your union is mobbed up?
Yes. Yes, I do.
What? I'm not going to start worrying about you yet.
Good. Yeah.
Tell me.
So you're applying to law school, and your goal is to start next year?
Fall of 2005.
Okay, and to go part-time?
I'm going to go full-time.
Full-time?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. I wish and hope that there was a way that I could work one or two Saturdays a month,
uh-huh.
you know, yeah. as a union tile setter. Mm-hmm. You know, when Lower Manhattan gets going and we have plenty of work,
mm-hmm.
you know, why wouldn't the union, if they needed union labor,
right.
let me work?
Uh-huh.
You know,
right.
unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to work during the week when
I'm
in school, yeah. but I would need some source of income. I also plan to continue to teach at New.
Okay.
I teach the job readiness class
mm-hmm.
at the night session. And I love teaching that class.
Mm-hmm.
I love getting the women
excited
and ready.
Uh-huh.
And I give them, you know, I shoot straight from the hip.
Mm-hmm.
I tell them, like a consumer report, you know, you recommend Best Buy, and
mm-hmm.
I say, listen, I know tile sounds great.
Mm-hmm.
You think, wow, you know, you hear violins playing in the background, you think, oh, you're going to make all these beautiful things, but let me tell you, you're on your knees, there's piss all over the place, because we tile around the toilet
right.
ring
mm-hmm.
on the floor, and the guy's pissing it, and there's urine everywhere. I said, there's got to be corruption going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so on. I said,
yeah.
So I'm not saying if somebody in this room really wants to do this, because that was me,
mm-hmm.
then, you know, that's what you do. But, you know, at New, we want to explain all your options,
mm-hmm.
and you should pick something that fits best for you. Ooh, that's scary.
So this would be, what year would you be running for office?
Okay, we just really went through an election cycle. So 2007.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. That's the year this book comes out. So
you'll
be mighty busy.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of affirmative action and the whole question of you know, the difficult period we're in now in terms of lack of commitment to the whole idea of affirmative action, but you know, you're out there on the front lines, and what do you see in terms of the relationships that you're able to develop with the people you're working with? And you think, what's your sense of how far we've come, how far we have to go?
It's like I said, there's a lot of academic talk, like the
mm-hmm.
the international union looks good on paper. Look, we have a task force.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we took these women, we send
mm-hmm.
them to Vegas, we send them to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it seems like something's done. I liken the women's task force to having hamsters in a cage, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You give them food and water, you put the wheel in there,
mm-hmm.
they run. They look so busy. Look,
yeah.
they're running. Let them
yeah.
out of the cage.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but you don't want that. Right, because then they're busy doing their own thing, and you don't have control anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, the task force is like kind of like this caged animal that looks busy,
mm-hmm.
and it's not happening in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've watched women come and go in my local, and it's because they're by themselves. They don't have access to skills, training, and support.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've watched the apprentice coordinator, John Costantini, you know, ridicule a woman rather than, you know, getting behind her saying, wow, you know what, let me think about this. She's the only Hispanic woman in this local. Gee, maybe she feels isolated. Maybe that's why she's a little bit edgy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
No, he just reads it as, you're ungrateful, you know. Why do you have such a bad attitude?